We've got a little Brexit on the show, a little oil, and just because we all need it, a story about puppets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 16th of November. Good to have you with us. It's been a big week in the global economy, with Britain's deal to leave the EU hanging in the balance and oil going up and down and up again. Fortunately, we've got the weekly wrap to help us make sense of it all. Joining me today are Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post and Dionne Reboen, co-host of Yahoo Finance's Midday Movers. Hi, you two.
Hey.
What's going on, Amy? Shout out Denver.
Yeah. I just found out Dionne is from Denver. Catherine, let's start with you, though. A big story in Europe this week, of course, was Brexit and British Prime Minister Theresa May's fight to save a deal to exit the European Union. What are the stakes of getting this done?
Well, here was the problem, that Britain voted to exit the European Union without exactly defining what that meant. And there's a very wide range of possibilities, a hard Brexit versus a soft Brexit, and that could mean lots of different things depending on who you are, whether you can import goods, for example, whether you can move around easily. And the deal that was revealed, this draft agreement, showed that it was more of a soft Brexit, that basically the UK will remain in a customs union with the EU for the foreseeable future. And that hasn't gone down so smoothly with her party. So the stakes are that her fate lies in the balance. Brexit itself lies in the balance. It could be the case that the parliament decides not to embrace this deal, and you could have a new deal. You could have a new referendum. You could have no deal, right? The UK could just exit the EU without anything in place. So there's a wide range of possibilities.
And Dionne, this matters not just for the British economy, really, but for the global economy. Why should folks here in America care about what's going on over there?
Well, one interesting thing that this is doing is really kicking up a lot of dust in the currency markets. I was talking to some strategists this week, and one of the things that's really been kind of pulling back profits for companies in the U.S. is the strong dollar, or at least that's what they say. It reached a 16-month high recently, and as all this turmoil is going on in London and in England and the U.K. and in Europe, that's pulling down the values of the euro and the British pound, which are the two biggest components of the dollar index. So when the dollar is stronger, it makes it harder for the U.S. to export things because things are more expensive, which makes it worse for our businesses. It's a good thing for American consumers, but it does tend to pull back the economy. So that's one thing that Americans should certainly be watching out for.
Right. And meanwhile, in the global economy, we also had some big swings in oil prices. The Economist called it Trumpsy-turvy. Catherine, what's going on there?
Well, you have a number of things going on. The U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia are pumping out crude at record levels. There's this question as to whether OPEC might decide that because prices have been falling, they'll coordinate a supply cut, which would anger Trump. He's been on record as saying that he favors cheap oil. So there are a lot of different factors here going on, but we've basically seen prices fall because there's been this big supply build.
Go ahead, Dionne.
No, I was just going to say, in addition to that supply build, you've got a number of things kind of weighing on the demand side, which are bringing down the demand for oil. So when there's less demand, more supply, naturally you see prices go down.
Right. Well, and speaking of prices going down, there's been some inflation news the last couple of weeks, and various Fed officials have been on the speaking circuit talking about the economy being pretty strong. But what about the sort of global hint of a slowdown, and how does that weigh on our economy going forward?
Yeah, I think that's actually part of the oil story, too. Again, I've been talking to people about this all week. And part of that reduced demand, and it also goes back to the first thing we talked about with the stronger dollar. So when the dollar is stronger, other countries' currencies are weaker, and it makes it harder for them to buy oil. It kind of slows down their economy. And you're starting to see now, we saw from Japan, from Germany, just this week, that their economies have really slowed down to about zero growth. And you're seeing it in a number of emerging countries, the former third world countries, just kind of the smaller, less developed developed countries. They're having a really hard time with this, especially countries that rely on exporting oil. So as they're starting to slow down, you're really beginning to see bits and pieces of this come up for the U.S. economy. And that's something people have to watch. Again, with this inflation thing, I think it's really interesting. We saw Jerome Powell come out and talk this week, and he really seems like a man who everything is coming up the way he planned it. You know, he said a couple weeks ago that the Fed wasn't anywhere near getting the neutral rate, which means more rate hikes, higher interest rates. And that really kind of scared some people and got people a little shook. But he really came out and doubled down on this. And he just kind of seems like a man who feels like he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's doing everything right.
Catherine, real quick before we go, it looks like we are on track for another interest rate increase next month. But then maybe after that, a pause. What do you think?
Well, the Fed has been trying to raise rates very slowly, not spook markets, and there is some debate about how quickly they should be raising rates. It seems likely that we'll continue, you know, at a relatively steady pace. The Fed's job is to take away the punch bowl. The economy seems quite strong. To take away the punch bowl just as the party gets going, right? The economy right. seems quite strong. We've had a huge fiscal stimulus this year, and you can understand why inflation hawks might be worried about future inflation, even if we're basically at our target now. We haven't exceeded it.
Yeah, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out the Jerome Powell actually mentioned the growing U.S. fiscal deficit, the budget deficit, approaching $23 trillion. And that's something I think people really need to keep their eye on.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that. Thanks for joining me, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post and Dion Rabowin of Yahoo Finance.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
On Wall Street, TGIF, a mixed day after a volatile week. Details when we do the numbers. The streaming content wars just keep heating up. Apple, the world's most valuable public company stock-wise, has partnered with the Oscar-winning indie film studio A24. The terms of the deal haven't been made public, but what is clear, there is lots of money going into this. Apple's reportedly spending $1 billion overall on original films and video series. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
For years, Apple's profits came from hardware, but those sales have stopped growing. Media analyst Will Kreth says now the question is,
what do you put on that phone? What do you put on that tablet? What do you put on the device that's going to make it special and different?
How about movies? TV. By partnering with A24, which has already produced Moonlight.
At some point, you got to decide for yourself who you want.
And Lady Bird.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird.
This makes Apple competition for Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon. Apple's also signed deals with Reese Witherspoon and Oprah Winfrey. Kevin Sandler, who teaches media studies at Arizona State University, says with partnerships like those, Apple is saying,
if you're interested in this type of filmic content, you know, come to us because we're going to be able to provide it compared to our competitors.
Netflix spends a lot more on content, $8 billion to Apple's reported $1 billion. But Apple potentially has a captive audience with all of their device users. Still, says Amanda Lotz at the University of Michigan, it's a perplexing move for Apple. Creating content makes sense for Amazon because it helps attract more shoppers. But for Apple, it's a stretch to think that a television show or movie
is going to be enough to move the dial for someone to move, let's say, from an Android ecosystem into an Apple ecosystem.
One thing it means for sure, another password for you to remember. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
It's been a year of transition for Wells Fargo after a series of scandals in its consumer banking business. The company's paid billions of dollars in penalties and just announced it's cutting 900 jobs in its mortgage division. The job cuts are part of a big restructuring plan the bank announced back in September, with over 26,000 jobs on the chopping block. But that's not the whole story. Average interest rates on a 30-year mortgage are hovering near 5%. And as rates go up, people just aren't taking out as many mortgages. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
With mortgage rates rising north of 5%, home buying and home borrowing have slowed down, says Dave Mann at UC Irvine.
We're seeing refinancing drop off a lot, and we're seeing new home sales stagnant or dropping a little bit. And, you know, collectively, that just means there's less demand for more mortgages.
Wells Fargo says that low demand for mortgages, along with low default rates, means fewer staff are needed to service those loans. J.P. Morgan recently said fewer people are struggling with mortgages and is planning layoffs, too. Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says big banks in general are moving away from mortgages.
We think of mortgages as a bread and butter product for banks, but in fact, the vast majority of the business has moved to non-banks.
Case in point, Quicken Loans, which earlier this year overtook Wells Fargo as the country's biggest mortgage lender. Petru says it's not just about rising interest rates.
The new rules ever since the financial crisis make it very difficult for banks to make loans in a profitable and affordable way.
Wells Fargo says the bulk of its mortgage layoffs will hit Des Moines, Iowa, where the bank is the region's biggest employer. Peter Arazem is a labor economist at Iowa State University.
You're probably not going to have as big a problem switching to a different firm in the Des Moines market as it would have been in the past, say, if it was a more slack market.
He says the unemployment rate in Des Moines is about 2%, well below the national average. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
As Justin just talked about, fewer people are applying for mortgages as the cost of borrowing goes up. But those who do apply may not get equal treatment, even if there's no human interaction involved. That's the finding from a new study from the University of California, Berkeley, which found that even when comparing people with the same range of credit scores applying for the same type of loan, race played a factor in how much borrowers were charged. Tracy Jan wrote about the study in The Washington Post. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy.
So racial bias has been pretty well documented in face-to-face lending. You'd think that, you know, online lending would take bias out of the equation, but I guess that's not the case. What did these researchers find?
That's right. Computers are just no better at evening the playing field than humans are. No matter if you went to a mortgage lender in person or if you applied for a loan online, as more and more banks are allowing you to do these days, Black and Latino borrowers pay a much higher price for the same loan, for the same kind of house, in the same neighborhood than white and Asian borrowers, even though they have the same credit risk.
So they have basically the same credit score. How can algorithms be racist?
That is a very good question. So what happens is banks are allowed to charge whatever they want to charge for competitive reasons. And some of them may be penalizing you if you live in a place where there's fewer banks. And so by knowing that there are fewer banks in that neighborhood, if there's less competition, then they could charge you more. And that's perfectly legal, except that where you live often correlates to race. You know, Black and Latino borrowers typically live in neighborhoods where there are much fewer banking opportunities around than white and Asians. So minorities are disproportionately affected by their current algorithms.
And talk about the consequences of that. How much more do they end up paying? And what does that mean for, you know, the larger racial wealth gap in our society?
Ultimately, this results in these banks making 11 to 17% higher profits off of these minority borrowers by charging them higher rates. So Black and Latino consumers end up paying 5.6 to 8.6 basis points higher interest.
So that would be like 5/100ths of a percentage point. And that adds up, right?
Absolutely. And ultimately, these have, you know, huge consequences for the already widening racial wealth gap. People think it's narrowing as discrimination supposedly is lessened over time because of these laws, you know, fair housing laws and other laws to outlaw racial discrimination. But in fact, wealth gap is widening in this country. So Black and Latinos are less likely to own homes than whites and Asians. And if they're going to be charged more for it, their debt is also higher.
All right. Tracy Jan covers the intersection of race and the economy at The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great being on.
Coming up,
we're just like entrepreneurs trying to bring some life back to a neighborhood. We're not like the devil. At least it's not a vacant storefront.
Tell that to the angry neighbors. But first, let's do the numbers. A mostly ho-hum day on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 123 points, about 0.5%, to end at 25,413. The S&P 500 tacked on 6 points, or 0.2%, to close at 2736. But the NASDAQ dropped 11 points, 0.1%, to close at 7247. For the week, the Dow shaved off 2.2%. The S&P 500 lost 1.6%, and the NASDAQ tumbled 2.1%. Shares of NVIDIA fizzled 18.75% after the computer chip maker reported disappointing earnings. Competitor Qualcomm saw its share price rise 0.8%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. It's Molly Wood here. And I am asking you to subscribe to a podcast I host with Kai Ryssdal. It's called Make Me Smart. Every week, we dig deep into all things tech, the economy, and culture. Tim Wu joins us on the show this week. He tells us why the big tech companies of today remind him of another time in U.S. history, the Gilded Age, and what the risks are if these big companies continue to expand and go unchecked by the government.
And that's something we really have to watch out for in the United States, is an extremist leadership which ends up in union with monopoly corporations across the board, leading a union of private and power. And I'm not an alarmist by nature, but I think it is time to sound the alarm.
Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to podcast.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Maybe you didn't know this, but the University of Connecticut is considered the school to go to for a master's degree in puppet arts. But breaking into a field as specialized as puppetry is no easy feat, especially if you graduate right before the economy crumbles. For our year-long project, Divided Decade, we've been reporting on how the 2008 financial crisis changed America and asking you, our listeners, to share stories of how it changed your lives. Today, 41-year-old Kate Katz, a native New Yorker and a proud holder of a UConn MFA in puppet arts.
Puppetry is a difficult field to go into. It's not impossible, but it's one that has obstacles that you definitely have to overcome. And the recession made those obstacles almost insurmountable. I had moved to Brooklyn after I left school with a 5-year plan. And in 2008, New York got gutted immediately. Production dried up overnight, especially children's television. Every day that I didn't have a job, every day that I didn't have work, I just felt closer and closer to being a failure. And I remember wrapping my head around the fact that, like, okay, maybe puppetry just wasn't going to be possible. So what are the other things that I could be doing? And, like, looking for other work. And there wasn't anything. Like, I remember I couldn't get work as a dog walker. There was an opportunity that came up in Los Angeles. It was a television commercial. It was for a Korean cell phone, I think. And the company that was doing this commercial wanted to bring in fresh blood. So I packed up the car and made the move. The recession rolled across the country like a wave. As I was driving, I felt like it was right in my rearview mirror, like, the whole time. And when I landed in L.A., I remember seeing signs of, like, what was to come because I had just been through it in New York. It was 2 years of unknown, just unknown wing and prayer, the most vulnerable part of my life. My sister fielded a lot of weeping phone calls, but the work slowly did start coming in. And what changed for me was that I was being introduced into a community out here. And with each opportunity, I felt that it was important to honor that community. So all of the relationships that I've made out here, it's almost a familial level. People who have given me work, helped me in my survival. These are relationships that I deeply, deeply honor. I'm now standing on a foundation that's more solid than I've ever felt. I have been shown the best of humanity through one of the worst periods in my life. I don't know if I would undo it, but it was a hell of a price to pay to see that.
We've got a picture of Kate on our Instagram at MarketplaceAPM. You can also tell us how the financial crisis changed you using the hashtag #HowWeChanged. Picture empty storefronts, and you might think of a neighborhood or even a whole town in decline. But in cities across the country, empty shops are proliferating in thriving neighborhoods. The phenomenon has given rise to a new kind of retail desert, and the struggles of brick-and-mortar retail in the age of Amazon are only part of the story. Janet Babin visited two very different bodegas in New York to explore what's going on.
It's lunchtime at the American Deli Market in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, a corner store and lunch spot that's been in business about 20 years.
We got yellow rice, white rice, beans.
Gene Sosa Mejias is fixing a hot meal for Suresh Modi, who works around the corner.
Yeah, yellow rice and beans.
Chicken, pork chop.
Chicken.
Modi says he's eaten lunch here most workdays for about a decade, but this will be his last meal here. Mejias says the deli's closing after the building owner refused to renew the store's $4,000 a month lease.
New York is just becoming too expensive for everybody. They take the small businesses out, put the big ones in.
For now, though, this space sits empty. The small deli personified old school Brooklyn in a neighborhood where asking rents for ground floor retail space has jumped more than 42% since 2016. In neighborhoods like this one, for rent signs can seem more plentiful than "yes, we're open" placards.
It feels like every block you walk on has at least one or two empty storefronts.
Jonathan Miller is president and CEO of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers.
This seems to be a phenomenon in not only New York, but in many other metro areas across the U.S.
Before the financial crisis, overbuilding led to a glut of retail space. Then, after the recession, investors shopped for real estate bargains, says Naveen Jaggi with real estate consultants JLL Jones Lang LaSalle. And they expected big returns.
But this is all right at the beginning of the large e-commerce that started transforming the way consumers shop.
That's the so-called Amazon effect. Physical stores losing ground to online sales. Some retailers couldn't afford the monthly rent, and vacancy rates started to climb. Jeremy Metz with BMO Capital Markets says the empty spaces persist in part because landlords are still being unrealistic.
You're actually seeing the authentic, the local entrepreneur or retailer who can't afford some of these rents and is getting pushed down.
New York and San Francisco are among the cities considering laws that would levy taxes on landlords who keep stores vacant. Metz says some landlords have begun to lower rents or to offer shorter commercial leases. But for other landlords, it's not just about money. It's also about vibrancy. Metz says putting a desirable retailer in a storefront can attract upscale tenants to the rest of the building.
How do you curate that space? Because that can have an impact on what you're leasing above.
Metz says these curated stores are bringing green shoots to some retail deserts. Take Clover Grocery in Manhattan's West Village.
Clover Grocery, this is Josh. How can I help you?
It's a tiny gourmet slash drug store in a space that used to be an eyewear store. It sells $10 charcoal toothpaste, $30 non-toxic candles, and one of the more popular items, says co-owner Kyle Hotchkiss-Caron, $15 vegan condoms.
I bet that when people read that we sell vegan condoms, they Google, like, what's the matter with regular condoms?
When he first opened, Caron says some neighbors complained that the store was too pricey, that it would force their local bodegas out of business. Here's what he told them.
We're just like entrepreneurs trying to bring some life back to a neighborhood. We're not like the devil. At least it's not a vacant storefront.
Caron signed a 10-year lease. And in the building where American Deli used to be, the landlord says She's looking for a new tenant that caters to the neighborhood. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, FAO Schwartz is back. The iconic New York City toy store closed its Fifth Avenue flagship 3 years ago after years of financial trouble. But today it reopened in a new 20,000 square foot location at 30 Rockefeller Plaza under new ownership. Pop-up holiday stores and smaller U.S. locations are also part of the plan. A giant keyboard like the one featured in the 1988 Tom Hanks movie Big is back, with replicas going for $128, along with plenty of more affordable toys and dolls, plus a child-sized drivable Mercedes-Benz encrusted with 44,000 Swarovski crystals. Price tag, $25,000. That's it. We've got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 123 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 11 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 tacked on 6 points, or 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Amy Scott. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.